Hey everybody, this is Joel Hoekstra of Whitesnake, and you're listening to Focus on Metal.
Hey, Metalheads, Scott Thompson here, welcoming you to another episode of Focus on Metal. Yep, we are halfway through October, and that means we are only weeks away from Metal Month. That's right, in just a few weeks from now, VH1 Classic will be trying to act like they've been trendy and cool about metal all year long. However, those of us who listen to metal all the time know that, with the possible exception of Eddie Trunk and That Metal Show, about the only time that station pays attention to metal is during the month of November. So, we'll enjoy it while it's here, right? We hope that you guys enjoyed last week's episode. That would be Little Mountain Sound Episode 5, talking to Bob Brooks, owner and manager of Little Mountain Sound, or at least owner and manager back in the day. If you haven't had a chance to check that one out, and be sure to head up to focusonmetal.net or over to iTunes and check that one out. I think you'll like it. And of course, a great place to keep track of all of your podcasts, whether they be video podcast or audio podcast, or even some of the great review blogs, is at earpeeler.com. And yes, I keep mentioning these guys, and no, they aren't paying me to do this. I really feel like it's a great site, and it's something you guys should check out, especially if you're an avid listener of podcasts. Earpeeler.com does all the aggregating for you, and you can keep up with all of the latest shows and discover some great new ones, as well as keep up with all of your favorite ones. So if you want to know who Jamie Josta has on this week, it's on earpeeler.com. If you want to see what our friends Chris and Aaron from the Decibel Geek are up to, it's up on earpeeler.com. And if you want to see what latest awesome show is coming out from Mars Attacks, again, it's up on earpeeler.com. All right, I feel better now. So we were going to do another Little Mountain Sound episode this week. Figure, you know, we're only in October, and I'm up to Massive Episode 5 about halfway through that series. So we were going to do one, but then Richie managed to book a great interview with Joel Hoekstra. And at one point a few months back, we were going to talk to Joel when Whitesnake put out the Purple album. Never managed to hook that one up, just timing and dates and all that kind of crap. But now, you know, Joel's coming out with a great new album. It drops this Friday, the 16th, and we thought it was a perfect time to have him on the show, be able to talk about the album, be able to talk about what's going on with Whitesnake. But, you know, again, more importantly, get you guys excited about Joel Hoekstra's brand new release entitled Joel Hoekstra's 13, Dying to Live, especially where he has got a metal shit ton of competition happening this Friday for releases. I mean, we're talking, first of all, the 800-pound elephant in the room. Saxon's coming out with Battering Ram. That one drops this Friday, October 16th. If you don't know that one, I don't know where you've been. But then you've got Satan Has putting out another one, Grave, Circle to Circle, Tyrant, Summit, and Madam Mayhem, just to name a few people that are putting out albums this Friday. So lots of competition for Joel, for getting everybody's metal dollars, but the guy has put out a great hard rock and metal album, and I think it really showcases a lot of what he can do, and he's backed up by Tony Franklin and Vinny Appice. So, I mean, how cool is that? And then on top of that, vocals, Jeff Scott Soto, and the one and only Russell Allen. So again, we're super stoked to have Joel on the show this week, and I hope you guys enjoy our chat with them. But before we do that, let's get into a track of the week. All right, so it's been a few weeks since I have done a track of the week, and originally this week I was all psyched. I thought I had a great track of the week for you, and that was one off of the brand new one out on October 2nd from Denner Sherman called Satan's Tomb. And of course, those of you into metal for a long time may know that Michael Denner and Hank Sherman were the original guitarists on a lot of those great old Merciful Fate albums. So if you go back and listen to things like Don't Break the Oath, that's Michael Denner and Hank Sherman. They even have Snowy Shar on drums on this one. and Sean Peck doing some vocal work. So the release is only a few songs long, but it is a great couple of songs, and I would urge you guys to go out and pick that one up. However, that one is coming out on Metal Blade. Of course, Metal Blade has always put out some great albums, but one thing that they're really not a big fan of is of podcast and internet radio doing samples of Metal Blade releases without any kind of authorization. So even though the great guys over at Metal Blade do send us pre-release versions of all their upcoming releases, they aren't designed to be aired on the show, but just for us to listen to for review purposes and get the word out on them. So that is what I'm doing this week. I'm getting the word out on this one. So again, check that one out. It's called Denner Sherman, and the release is Satan's Tomb. Great, great EP. So fortunately, I have a backup plan. And amazingly, it's another album that is out on October 16th. I am talking about the album Waterfall by Voodoo Hill. And those of you guys who don't know who Voodoo Hill is, well, primarily it is the amazing Glenn Hughes and guitarist Dario Molo. So that's got all of the Glenn Hughes-y goodness all over this one. It is from our friends at Frontiers. And again, this one drops this Friday, the 16th. But they have released two singles already, so that means that even though the album itself hasn't been released, singles have been released. That means I get to play one of them. So from Waterfall by Voodoo Hill, this is one of the two singles they've released. This one is called The Well. So sit back and just revel in the beauty that is the voice of Glenn Hughes. So if you haven't already done so, be sure to go and pick up your own copy of Waterfall by Voodoo Hill. And I do know that Richie is working on possibly getting, dare I say it, I'm going to say it. He's working on trying to get Glenn Hughes to come on the show with the release of Voodoo Hill. So I don't know. Cross your fingers. It might happen. We do have a pretty good relationship with Frontier Records. Hey, who knows? Maybe we'll even get Dario Molo on. Either way, go pick that one up. It's a great album. And again, while we're at it, you probably are going to want to go ahead right now before you even hear the interview and pre-order Joel Holkstra's 13, Dying to Live. And of course, in the interview, he'll explain the whole 13 and dying to live. But right now, trust me, just go out there and hit pause and go pre-order this album. I think after you hear it and you hear what Joel has to say about it, that I think you're going to definitely want to pop that one into your stereo. So hopefully Joel Holkstra is not a totally new name for you, but if he is, let me fill you in. He, of course, played with Night Ranger, and then when Doug Aldrich left Whitesnake, he took Doug's place. Joel has also played with Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and in his past, he's also done a lot of other things as well. He is a killer guitar player, as you will hear when you go out to see Whitesnake live, or if you pick up the brand new album Joel Holstra's 13, Dying to Live. So, of course, this release features two great vocalists, Jeff Scott Soto and Russell Allen, and I thought I'd like to play you a sample of each of those guys' contributions to the album. And just like Voodoo Hill, fortunately, Frontiers has done a really nice job of issuing singles prior to the album release, and that means I actually have a couple of examples of tracks from both singers to choose from. So to start things off, I'm going to play a sample of a track with Jeff Scott Soto on vocals. We'll merge right into the interview with Joel, and later on during the interview, I will play you a great track featuring the mighty Russell Allen. So this one is called Until I Left You, and as I said, it features Jeff Scott Soto on vocals. And just listen to that Vinny Appice intro. How are we doing tonight, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, awesome. I know that, you know, Richie's been wanting to have you on ever since the Purple album came out, and we kind of missed connecting with you on that one, but we've got an even better opportunity, I think, right now with the brand new solo album that you have coming out. That way there you can talk not just about Purple, but really about your own music, which is really what we'd love to hear about.
Oh, thanks so much. I totally appreciate the support on it.
Awesome. So, of course, Richie's like he is ready. He has got questions. He's raring to go. So I'm going to turn you over to Richie.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. All right, Joel. We've actually had Reb on the show this year and Doug Aldridge on the show. And we've had Adrian Vandenberg on the show. And now you're the fourth Whitesnake guitarist we've had this year.
Well, there's what, 137 of us? No. I shouldn't joke about that. It's an honor to be associated with those fine gentlemen.
Yeah, so I do want to get into the Purple album a little bit up front before we dive into the solo stuff. What was your initial reaction when you found out that David wanted to do an album of Deep Purple reworks?
I was really excited about it. I mean, that was my initial meeting with David, and I looked at it like a great opportunity to get acclimated with the band and a great opportunity to put my own spin on some great proven songs and have an opportunity to work with rock royalty like David and a kick-ass lineup, you know, with Tommy Aldridge on drums and be in a guitar team with Red Beach. So I was very excited about it.
Yeah, so how far into the project were they when you got involved?
The pre-production was, for the most part, in place. I did the acoustic arrangements for, I guess there was a rough one for Sail Away. Essentially the songs had been chosen and pre-production was in place and tracking was about to begin.
Okay. And how familiar were you with those Purple albums that David had sang on? Like, were they classics for you?
Not very at all.
Oh, okay.
No, I basically knew Burn and Stormbringer and Mistreated.
Okay.
So that was about it.
So you had to go back to school?
It was a great opportunity to get educated on it for me. I mean, I listened to all the originals, did nothing but listen to them for a few weeks, and then I transcribed it all of Richie's parts and Tommy Bolin's parts on the respective songs. And then when we went into track, I just tried to have as many ideas together as possible because I knew most of those songs were built off of one guitar part.
Yeah.
And Reb was going to have a lot of that covered. So for me, it was this cool opportunity of, okay, we're not going to use as much keyboards as the Deep Purple version. So for me, it was like, all right, let me think of some cool second guitar parts that would fit with a lot of this stuff, or different sounds, or setups for songs, or little cutaway moments that could really help put our stamp on it. You know, little things like the tapping setup for Lay Down, Stay Down, or the dobro setup for Might Just Take Your Life. There's a little like piece at the end of Holy Man that I came up with, which I mean is a completely different version than the original Holy Man. And David also turned the acoustic stuff over to me, the Sail Away and Soldier of Fortune, all me acoustic, just layering all those parts. And so it was a lot more of a creative process, I think, than people realized at first when they heard, oh man, it's a cover album or whatever. But the way I looked at it, it wasn't a re-record note for note kind of scenario at all. I mean, it was, in many cases, many of those songs were really reimagined. Like I said, Holy Man and Sail Away. And so, I mean, between coming up with all these different parts and coming up with our own solos and everything, it really felt like a creative process.
Yeah. Did you do a couple of different takes on the songs, or was the take on the song the one that ended up on the album? Like, was there a lot of experimentation done and some of it was left in and others were taken out?
There's some stuff where there's like alternate versions that David is putting out, and I'm a little not clear on where they're getting used, but I know there's like a Stormbringer version with my solo in, because it was just too long with my solo in, basically. I mean, it was 7 minutes or something like that. We're going to cut a video for it and everything, so it just didn't make a lot of sense to have... So, like, you know, that, and I think there's a version of Soldier of Fortune that's just one nylon string guitar and David that he has out. That might be the Japanese bonus track.
Yeah.
And I know there was a variety of other ones he sent me, just with, like, alternate mixes and alternate takes. Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of content for it, I felt like. I mean, I think all in all, we recorded 15 songs, so... Then with alternate mixes and alternate takes and things like that, it was a lot of content.
Yeah, now did David say up front that he didn't care what ideas he had, that like you could always tell him and he could either say yes or no anyway? Like, he didn't say to you guys, like, I want to do Burn like the original, I want to do Sail Away, I want to strip that one down. The environment was to experiment as much as possible and see what worked and what didn't.
Well, a lot of like what you're talking about, like the basic concept of what the take would be like, was in place by the time I came on board.
Okay.
Like, because the pre-production was in place, so I wasn't necessarily a part of like, hey, let's do an acoustic version of Sail Away. That decision was already made, if that makes sense. So for me, the creativity entered into like parts. And
okay.
Things like that, and solos, and trying to just put our own stamp on it a bit.
Yeah. Now, of course, there's probably like the guts of 30 tracks on those albums. Was there any track that you, after listening to the three of them, that you would have loved to do that you didn't get a chance to do?
Honestly, I wouldn't even be able to tell you, man, because the ones that I familiarized myself with were the ones I knew we were recording.
Yeah.
It didn't really enter in. There were a couple, though, in listening with David around when we were tracking that he put on. And I was like, wow, well, that's kick-ass. How come we're not doing that one? But what they were right now, I couldn't even tell you.
Yeah, and I'm sure David was telling you a lot of the stories about the tracks when you were doing them, when they were recorded originally.
It's pretty awesome to work with him. I mean, one minute he's cracking you up because he's an extremely witty, charming guy, and then the next minute he's telling you stories about working with Jimmy Page and with Richie Blackmore. So yeah, there's not many guys that can do that.
You know? Yeah.
Turn on a dime from a joke to telling you a story about, you know, working with Richie Blackmore. So yeah, I definitely try to pay attention and soak in whatever I can from David. Like I said, I pretty much always refer to him as rock royalty. I just think he's a living legend and deserves my utmost respect, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like you want to take the gig just for the stories.
Exactly. Forget anything else. Hey, how much are you getting paid? Oh, nothing, actually. It's just stories.
We talked to Reb. He does a great version of David.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Reb's got David down. Michael Devin can do him as well. But my voice just isn't low enough.
Yeah, so Joel, the album's been out for a while now. Are you surprised at how negative some of the reviews have been? Because I got Classic Rock magazine and it hammered it, and David did an interview in the magazine, and you know, he was pretty upfront in his views about, you know, some of the reviews being so negative. He was saying, like, you know, he was, what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, I think David was mainly referring to just like some comment, like, you know, basic comments online, like at the bottom of articles. I mean, really the only one that was super negative was Classic Rock.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that was, you know, I personally feel like maybe something personal between them, or I don't really know the story there, but it wasn't much of a music review, to be honest with you. That particular review just sort of didn't like the concept of it and basically just cited that we weren't famous enough to be recording it, in my view. I mean, he just said David chose to do this with guys who weren't famous or big names enough to do it. And what does that have to do with music? Sorry. Yeah. So if he had, somebody who can barely play guitar on lead guitar, he got Johnny Depp in to play lead guitar on it, that would have been cool. I don't know, you know. So yeah. That wasn't much of a review in my personal opinion.
Yeah, I think that some people just have this thing about reworks, and I'm going to be honest, I'm a little bit on the fence about them as well, because if you have an album like that's a classic album, you don't really want anyone to go near it. To me, it's like when Ozzy Osbourne's first two albums were re-released with Mike Borden and Robert Trujillo as the rhythm section, there was like uproar over something like that. And certain fans, they just don't want anything
touched.
Yeah,
but that's two completely different scenarios, yeah. Really. I mean, that was trying to replace guys' existing tracks on something and basically not even really inform people about it. So that would be like if Reb and I went in on the original Deep Purple recordings and tried to overdub guitar parts on it. So, I mean, that's really a way different scenario. I mean, I think with this, David was upfront in that it was a reimagining, and he wanted to basically just do it as a tribute to his old colleagues. And everybody knows the story by now. He had kind of reached out to Richie, and that's when he began the creative work on it, because I think that they just couldn't get on the same page in terms of what they wanted to do with it business-wise or whatever. So I don't really know the specifics of it. But then Cindy, he was, I think, out to eat with Cindy, and he just said, what a shame, I've done all this work, and, you know, we're not on the same page. And she said, why don't you do this with Whitesnake? It could be really cool. And like I said, for me, just coming on board, I viewed it like a really great opportunity to get acclimated with the band. And I feel like we definitely put our own spin. We just gave like people like alternate versions of those songs so they could choose to like or not like. Definitely not trying to put one over on people or re-record a master, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, when we had Reb on the show, we went through his whole career, and when we started talking to him about him getting into Whitesnake, we asked him about the solos for the live show, and he said that Doug told him what solos to do because he was in the band before him. Now, with Reb being in the band before you, when it came to the live shows, was it the same scenario? Did Reb say, right, you can do these ones and I'll do these ones, or was it more of a collaboration?
I would say Reb still, he's the band leader, so he's technically in charge, but I think Reb is, he's kind of like myself, where neither one of us really want to be the guy to do every lead. I've never really been that kind of guy. So I think he was good in just taking an objective look at it and going, hey, this one would be cool if you played it. And there was ones that he felt like he would like to have, and I definitely felt like I got my fair share. So I think Reb and I work well together in that regard. Neither one of us are overly aggressive in needing to play every lead or be the guy, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, you did a show, I believe, in L.A., and Glenn Hughes got up on stage. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
How cool is that, you know? I mean, it felt like a really historic moment having Glenn show up. And I had heard, like, some, you know, whispers that was maybe going to happen, and I really didn't think it was going to happen. And then and when he showed up backstage, I was like, wow, this is super cool. And as cool as it was having him up on stage with us and as fun of a moment as that was, it might have been more fun backstage because to go through the stuff, we were just kind of jammed into this tiny little dressing room together, all right on top of each other, playing with no amps. kind of going through the songs, and it was really neat to have him and David side by side singing with no PA, no microphones, nothing, and you just knew it was like, it was just a magical moment, and it was super cool to be a part of.
Yeah, now the Purple songs, when you started playing them live, do you feel that they even went somewhere else completely from the album at times when you were playing them in the live show?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I feel like the band feels like we took a step forward in terms of the ability to play the material and interpret it the way we want live. I mean, those songs are just meant for live performance, really. So we really had a great time on this opening leg of the Purple tour. We did 3 months here in the U.S. essentially, and what a great set, man, to have all the Whitesnake hits in it and then be able to pull from the the Purple stuff and have those in there. I mean, the band was pretty much every night we'd get on the bus and go, man, I love playing our set. And everybody's like, yeah, me too. What a cool set. I mean, just kicked ass. So I think it was good too for guys who've been around for a while, like Tommy and Reb, and even Michael Devin now is in his fifth year with Whitesnake, to have some new songs to, and by new, I mean 40 years old, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To have some new material in the actual set, I think it was really a good positive thing for everybody.
Yeah. So you've known David a while now. Can you tell us something you didn't expect from him, from what you've read or heard about him in the past that surprised you?
I'm just kind of taking it as it comes with David, but I still feel very positive about the experience of working with him. I've been around now for over a year, and to me, he's been incredibly supportive and generous, and like I said, a fun, funny, witty guy, and very talented. I mean, him writing is, forget it. I mean, it's extreme of consciousness,
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know that I've necessarily been surprised by anything, because I don't know what I expected coming in.
Yeah.
But it's gone great.
Okay, excellent. So, of course, the other reason we have you on is you've got a solo album coming out soon, 13, Dying to Live. Can you tell me how old some of the tracks are on that?
How old
are they? Like, when did you write them?
How old?
Yeah.
Well, there's most of them, the second, and all the Jeff Scott Soto stuff was written pretty recently. A couple of the songs I'd had versions of kicking around for a really long time that were just kind of old demos and things like that. And most of it, though, was written within the last year or two.
Okay.
Say the bulk of it.
Got to tell you that on that one, as far as me listening through it, Scream to me is just like a tour de force. And to hear the keyboard guitar interaction section on that, I was like going back and just listening to that over and over again. Just for me, my favorite track on that album just blew me away.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much. Yeah, Derek Sherinian did a great job on there. I mean, yeah. what a great thing to have a player like Derek playing on the album for me. He played on every track. It's just really, I mean, I, after I was done laying a lot of my guitar parts down, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to have keyboards on there, really. But then I still felt like there was room. And so Derek, in a lot of ways, just had to be really minimalist and tasteful on the whole record. And then we just figured out a couple solo spots for him, and that was one of them. But, you know, a tip of the cap to him for just being a total pro and just playing tastefully on the whole record to make all the songs work.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely one of these guys that he could go in and just, like, you could just hear, like, Derek Sherinian stamp all over everything. But it's really cool that he can go into a project like yours, and on Scream, you go, oh, yeah, that's Derek. But other places, he's just kind of adding what the song needs without putting Derek all over it. So he's definitely one of those tasteful players. But in reality, I mean, you've got... what a dream team, right? You look on it and it's like, holy crap, Tony Franklin and Vinny Appice. And we've had both those guys on the show, and just the three of you guys in there, and then throwing, you know, either Jeff or Russell on top of that is just just an amazing lineup for an album.
Yeah, I think Russell Allen and Jeff Scott Soto, I mean, are two of the best singers in rock today, in my opinion. And just to have them, really, their voices bringing the songs to life is an honor for me. I mean, I wrote really everything on it. I wrote the lyrics and the vocal melodies. And so for me, this album was really about giving a lot of my fans that have gotten to know me from the bands I've been playing with the solo album they've been asking for from me. I mean, I had three solo albums out years ago that were instrumental guitar albums.
Right.
So, you know, when you get the fans of Night Ranger and people that knew me from Rock of Ages or Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and now, of course, Whitesnake, they'd listen to these two fusion albums and this fingerstyle acoustic album. They go, can't you put something out that's a little more like, you know, just like what we're used to hearing?
Yeah.
And so this is that album.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to do it, too. I mean, it sounded like a great idea. I've just been exceedingly busy, man. I mean, I've really, over the last 7 years, had about 350 shows a year with all the stuff I was doing. So the last year or two during downtime, I managed to get this done. And like I said, I'm floored at the initial reaction to it. And there's a whole lot of positivity surrounding it. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, so Joel, did lyric writing come easy to you?
Yeah, it did in this case. I just kind of followed where my head's been in the last year or two. For me, a lot of it's just been about, like, self-improvement and change and trying to make, you know, just become a better person and all that stuff. So I think that really most of the lyrics are about that. Some of them are a little fantasy-based in that department and not a direct reflection of my life, but... others are very direct reflection of it. So,
yeah.
I've been using the line that, you know, it's about the struggles and overcoming obstacles in your life to become the person you want to be.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the album title, like 13 Dying to Live. What's the meaning behind it?
Well, in terms of the 13, like I said, that's really the project name. It's Joel Hoekstra's 13.
Mm-hmm.
And because I felt like to call it a solo album was a little misleading, that people might be expecting guitar licks all over the place. And I mean, as you can hear when you listen to it, it sounds very much like a band. I just wrote it with, you know, tried to avoid getting too progressive or having the too overly self-indulgent long guitar solos and things of that nature. I just want to make it about good, solid rock songs, tastefully played by great players. So in the end, I had this project of what basically sounded like a band. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I can't really call it a band. It's not fair to those guys. I mean, I did all the writing. So the project name seemed to be the most appropriate thing. Joel Hoekstra's 13 is the project name. And then as far as Dying to Live goes, that title for that particular song just seemed to sort of sum up all the themes of, like I said, that struggle basically in life just to become a better person.
Yeah. Now, a lot of solo artists, they play as many of the instruments on as possible. Did you ever think about playing bass on it at all? Or did you just say, right, I just want to get a band?
Yeah, I early on there was designs on possibly having it be more of a band thing. I didn't know what it was going to become. It was kind of step by step. I didn't even really set out to do a super band kind of thing, really. I just set out to record a cool album of rock songs. That was as I told you, that was really what fans were wanting from me. So I just thought, yeah, absolutely, that was the thought. And I thought, well, maybe it'll be a band, maybe it'll be a project, maybe it'll be a solo album. I really don't know, but I'm just going to start asking all my favorite musicians or friends of mine in the business to work on this. And so, yeah, the lineup just kind of came together piece by piece. And I even, you know, halfway through, I wasn't sure, is this a band? What is this? I really didn't know. And then as it just became clear, a project thing was the thing that made the most sense. And the name allows us to move forward if we wanted to make it into a band and collaborate on writing in the future. Or I could continue to release solo projects under that name with whatever musicians I wanted to.
Yeah. Now, when you sent the demos out to Tony and Vinny and Russell and Jeff, was your guide vocals on it? Like, what? How complete were they when you sent them out?
It was different for each singer, but in general, the gist of what happened was I would demo the scratch guitar tracks, and then I would lay down scratch vocal melodies with my guitar as well, and even harmony parts, and that would go to Vinny. So he'd kind of hear the sense of what a song would sound like in terms of, you know, the chorus popping and whatnot with harmonies. And so he basically played to that, and then it went to Tony. And then it's a little grayer in terms of what order it happened in, but my real guitars eventually went down on it to them, and the vocals, background vocals and keyboards.
Yeah. Now, was it a fairly easy album to get done, or was there a lot of constant back and forth on certain tracks? Like, was one track a lot harder than the others, or were they all pretty okay to do?
In terms of the musicians, I think it was really easy.
Yeah.
I just basically had a production style of letting everybody play what they wanted to play. So sometimes that steered songs in different directions than I pictured, but I usually find you can get over that stuff just by listening to it. If you tend to like think, oh no, that's not what I pictured. And, but if you just give it a chance for a minute and live with it for a day or so and check it out, a lot of times you go, yeah, man, this is great. What this is, you know, a cool version of this song that was in my head. So, I thought that allowed everybody to get their personalities on there. And I think you get the best results out of players if you just sort of leave them alone and let them do their thing instead of telling them what to play.
Yeah. Now, was there anyone on your list of singers that you weren't able to get first? Because you've got Russell on it and you've got Jeff Scott Soto on it. They're two amazing singers. But was there anyone else you were looking for? And you just couldn't get them?
Well, at the tail end, there was a couple songs that needed some high harmonies, and I had been talking with Tony Harnell, who's singing with Skid Row now, and from TNT, of course, and he was into it and wanted to sing on them, but he unfortunately got like sick right at the deadline, right in the little window of time he had to do it. So unfortunately, I couldn't get Tony on there, but I think, you know, hopefully Tony and I will work together and some way, shape, or form down the road. And, you know, we're both kind of fans of what each other are doing. So, but in terms of the lead vocalists, no. I mean, I feel like I got two of the best in rock, man. Yeah. What more could I want, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, we had Mike LePond on from Symphony X a few weeks ago, and we were talking to him about Russell Allen, and we said what an amazing singer he is, and he said that he's fearless. You can just ask him to try anything and he'll just try it and he'll nail it.
Yeah, I think Russell can sing a lot more than people realize, certainly a lot more than I realized going in. I hadn't really listened to Symphony X much when I went to go check Russell out. And I had heard Adrenaline Knob, which I think he's a little grittier and lower in. And but man, I mean, he can really get after what I was looking for on a lot of this stuff. I described the album as sounding kind of Dio-ish at its heaviest and Foreigner-ish at its lightest. So I wanted somebody who could have that grit, that kind of, you know, Dio power, because some of the stuff was going to be heavy. And I couldn't very well have a nice, like, clear voice singing that stuff. And at the same time, some of the stuff had really high range written. I'd written the vocal melodies and words and everything. And I was sort of hearing like Lou Gramm in my head on a lot of the stuff. So, and Russell can sing that stuff. I mean, it's really pretty amazing that somebody can go from Ronnie James Dio to Lou Gramm. But he's capable.
But in my ear, you showed me fantasies that only disappear. Yeah. I'll never know why it felt so right. You're doubting all the wrong, blind to the consequence, seduced by your soul, enjoying human sacrifice. You dance upon.
Have a song on the album that you're especially proud of, that you like, there's one song that you're like, wow, I can't believe I actually wrote that one. I'm really proud of it.
No, not really. I sort of am proud of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, I think it's a diverse album, but it has a flow to it and it has a sound to it. So, I didn't want to have an album out of 11 tracks that all sounded the same. That's a pet peeve of mine when you get a CD from somebody and every song sounds the same because they wanted to make it easier to market or something. So, I mean, me personally, I've always liked bands that had a little diversity on their albums, you know, like Zeppelin and stuff like that, or you could hear the different styles. And anyway, I wanted something with some versatility to it. But I did want to have a flow and a sound. So in terms of that, I really owe a big thanks to Chris Collier, who did a great job mixing it in terms of giving it a sound. And I also just basically did all the guitar tracks with a Les Paul on the same amp, which helped to give it a sound. And to the fact that everybody used the same instruments for the whole record, it allowed it to all sound kind of cohesive.
Now what would be your definition of success for the album?
I really don't know. I mean, I'm just going to try and be productive every day overall with music and with this in terms of pushing it as far as it can go. I don't want to sell it short, but at the same time, I'm always happy, really. I mean, I'm not exactly Jimmy Page or Slash or something like that, a big household name. So for me, it's fun doing this. I mean, to get an opportunity to have a worldwide release, to have an album come out with songs that I wrote, it's effing fun, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great opportunity for me. So I'm already happy in a lot of ways, but that doesn't mean I'm even close to saying this is good enough. I mean, I'm definitely going to push it and support it as far as I can.
Yeah.
So, of course, you mentioned you know, a Les Paul in one amp, and I'm like the ultimate gear whore. And Richie doesn't play it all, so he doesn't understand my fascination with needing to have more and more guitars and amps. So I have to know what kind of amp you used.
Oh, I used a Friedman BE-100.
Oh, okay.
And on the whole thing, and a cabinet with 25-watt Celestions in it, and then just a 57 for the mic, nothing else. So, yeah, actually, my friend Alex King loaned me his BE-100, as mine were all the way across the country in storage. So, anyway, very kind of him.
Yeah,
should
definitely
give him a little shout-out for that.
Yeah. I mean, those, I've been watching those over the last 4 or 5 years, just really slightly, you know, they're gaining traction with a lot of bigger guitarists that really like the sound of the Friedman. So it's great to see that they're just getting, you know, out there more and more.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly, I mean, how many times have you heard the phrase Marshall on steroids, right?
Right.
Everybody always says that an amp is that, but the Friedman is the closest thing I've heard to really sounding like that. Just, you know, really fat, high gain, just fantastic tone for days.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That's right there. You got a classic setup going there. I can't argue with that one.
Yeah. And as the years have gone by, just the more I track and lay down, I just always use a Les Paul. It's just, you know, the perfect sounding guitar. It's the perfect combination of fat tone and punchy tone, I think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I know I had Dave Reffitt over here like a month and a half ago, and he was tracking a solo for a friend of his for an album, and he brought his guitar over, and he's always been eyeing my Les Paul every time he comes over to track, and he finally was like, you know what? I really think I need the Les Paul in this. Can I play the Les Paul? And then that was it. He was just playing, you know, the rest of the night, it was just all Les Paul for him, and yeah, I mean, you really can't go wrong with it.
Yeah, it's sort of the staple when you're multi-tracking or doubling parts for somebody to say, now you use a different guitar on this double, you know, use a Strat or a Tele to go with it.
Mm.
But for me, I always, even with that nowadays, I go, you know, it just sounds better with two Les Pauls playing, honestly, or three or four Les Pauls. So it's, I think that helped though on this particular album to give it a sound. Like I said, I didn't want to confuse people and have it get too scattered and, quite honestly, I mean, that led to some of our selection of what was going to be or what were going to be the bonus tracks for the album, too, because Killer Be Killed, the digital download bonus track, it's just too heavy, really, to fit with the other 11. It just got a little too heavy to have it all make sense with some of the lighter stuff for me. And Never Want, which is the Japanese bonus track, was actually more of like a blues-based riff. So as soon as you introduce those two elements, it got a little too confusing, I think, for me, and a little too scattered. So I definitely wanted to have a sound, and that was all part of the selection. But I didn't necessarily want to totally limit what I was going to lay down. So those tracks are out there for fun, for people to hear what lived on the fringe of it, you know? Mm.
Yeah, no, and that's a great way of doing it too. And that you did because you kind of have some varied styles on the album, which is great. I think there's something on there for everybody. It connects with everybody, a very wide audience for it. But yeah, by having that more or less, you know, commonality through all of it, just makes it a whole cohesive thing, which is really cool. And it's kind of a clever, not in your face way of doing it. So I think it came out really well.
Thanks. Yeah, like I said, I'm really excited about the reception that it's getting so far, and the further I can take it, the better, man. You know, and that's why I appreciate guys like yourself taking the time to chat with me about it. I think it's just going to be a long process. I think a lot of people are just sort of learning who I am or don't know who I am. So every little bit helps.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, the one thing that I feel bad about is, I mean, it's great that it's coming out on October 16th, so I can actually have a physical CD in my hand because it's way better than digital, but there's like so many albums coming out on October 16th. It's like, couldn't they give you a better chance of like a week back or a week forward? If I was an artist, I'd be like, oh God, I don't want to do October 16th. Everybody's releasing that day.
I don't know what to say about that. I don't know, man. I'm just going to kind of keep going on it. There's, you know, they're up online right now. People can check out the Any More lyric video. The Any More is one of the songs, of course, and Until I Left You, which is, there's a video for online. There's a song sampler video. And coming up here in 2 days, there's another one of the singles coming out. And also on October 2nd, I believe, and October 16th. So they're rolling out 5 singles for it. I feel like they're really doing a great job so far of pushing the album.
Yeah, and that's something that I should note, too, that I'm glad you brought that up, that, you know, a lot of times before the album comes out, they may put, like, one single out there, but the fact that you've already got so many of them available is really giving people a nice flavor of what to expect, and I think that's a great thing they did on their part.
I think so, too, and I think they're probably smart in that. Like I said, it's not like, the new Queensryche album is coming out, for instance, or something where people kind of know what to expect because they've been Queensryche fans for 25 years or whatever it is now, 30 years. So with something like this where people aren't as familiar with it, it gives people an opportunity to check it out. And I also just think people are going to dig it, dude. I mean, it's just good, solid, melodic hard rock. Anybody that likes that style of Dio through Foreigner, I think, is actually going to really dig this album.
I couldn't have put it any better than that, Dio through Foreigner.
That's me, Joel. I love all that stuff.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's really right in my wheelhouse of what I grew up on as a kid, you know. So it was a lot of fun for me to make this.
Yeah, so I can't let you go without asking about, has there been any talk about writing with David on the new Whitesnake album, all original material?
Well, I just came back from being out with David for about 10 days. So I'll let him fill everybody in terms of specifics on that. But I can tell you David's very enthused about the current lineup of Whitesnake. And I think he's got a couple projects in mind in terms of that. And is maybe eyeing doing quite a bit more over the next year or two. I think it's going to be a very active next year or two for Whitesnake.
Nice.
Good. And so, of course, also before we let you go, just if you want to just let everybody know where they can reach you online, you know, Twitter and websites and Facebook and all that.
Okay. Well, my name is extremely difficult, right? As Reb said when he told Kip Winger that I was getting the Whitesnake gig, Kip said, "Oh, that guy should have gotten a stage name years ago."
That's a good Kip.
That is a good Kip. We've had Kip on too.
Yeah, that's actually, Reb does an outstanding Kip. I mean, you literally think it was Kip Winger. But everybody could just go to my .com. I'll spell my name because it's difficult. Joel, J-O-E-L, and my last name is Hoekstra, H-O-E-K-S-T-R-A.com. And, you know, you can find, there's a million things to look at on there, and people can link over to any of my social network stuff from there. And there's the pre-order links for the album and all the videos we were talking about. So
awesome.
Hopefully people will head on over there.
Yep.
I hope so. Great. Both of us were super psyched about the new album. Hopefully everybody else that hears it will also be as psyched as we are. Because, you know, definitely when Richie said, "Hey, you know, we're going to have Joel on, what do you think?" And I was like, "Hell yeah." And just couldn't wait to talk to you about the album, because I really just think that that Dying to Live is just an amazing piece of music. I hope that everybody else sees it the same way.
Well, thanks so much. I really do truly appreciate the support and helping me kind of build it up a bit and see what can become of it. It's kind of exciting.
Great.
Excellent.
Well, we appreciate you taking some time tonight to talk to us. And of course, you're welcome to come back on Focus on Metal anytime to talk about anything you're doing in the world of music. We'd love to let everybody know about it.
Awesome. Well, hopefully next time I'm on, we'll be talking Whitesnake, right?
There you go.
That'll be nice.
All right, Joel. Well,
all right, cool.
Have a good night. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks so much.
No problem, Joel. Bye.
Bye-bye.
There you go, our talk with Joel Hoekstra. Definitely a very cool guy to talk to, and you can see, I mean, he's pretty mellow, low-key, and doesn't really take himself too seriously. So that was definitely a very good chat, and big thanks go out to Richie for setting that one up, and I know that he is very busy setting up quite a few other ones. And yes, Valaria, in answer to your question, yes, he is trying to get Michael Sweet to come back on and talk about the new Striper album with us. I'm pretty sure that one will not be a problem. Michael's been on quite a few times already and even had Richie up to one of his gigs a few months ago. So we have that in the works and lots of other good stuff that we're busily working on as well in our ever-roving quest to bring you the best in heavy metal and hard rock every single week. So that is a wrap for this week. As I always say, you can keep up with us on Twitter, on Facebook, as well as on our two websites, focusonmetal.blogspot.com and our main website, focusonmetal.net, where you can hook up with all of our prior episodes. So as we roll out of here this week in our quest, as I said, to bring you the best hard rock and heavy metal, as you may well know, our friends of Sound of Thunder put out their brand new one, Tales from the Dead Side. You can read my review of that one up on focusonmetal.blogspot.com. But hey, let the music speak for itself, right? So I'm going to play you a great track off of that one. And that is how we are going to roll out of here tonight. And of course, if you'd like to pick up a copy of this for yourself, you can go up to focusonmetal.blogspot.com. You'll see a big album graphic there on the right-hand side. You can click on that and go right to a Sound of Thunder store and pick up a copy. You can also go to asoundofthunderband.com. Click the links there. You can get this one on Amazon, or at least I hope you can get it on Amazon. I know that the week after it came out, the sucker actually sold out on Amazon, but you can definitely try on Amazon as well. And if you like the old digital download, you can pick it up on iTunes and also over at Bandcamp. And, you know, if that's not enough and is it ever enough, you want to go see these guys live, just to let you know that A Sound of Thunder is doing some dates this week. October 14th, they're at Baltimore Soundstage. On November 6th, they are at Tremont Music Hall in Charlotte, North Carolina. On the 7th, they're in Marietta, Georgia at the 120 Tavern. On November 8th, they're in DeLand, Florida at OB's Restaurant and Lounge. On the 11th, they'll be in Hattiesburg, Missouri at the Tavern. November 12th in Houston at the BFE Rock Club. November 13th in Austin at Hole in the Wall. And they come back to the home turf of Virginia, Falls Church, Virginia on November 20th. At the Falls Church VFW, and they're always announcing more dates as well. So you do yourself a favor, go to asoundofthunderband.com and keep up with everything that is going on with Nina and Josh and Jesse and Chris. And of course, if you were lucky to catch one of those dates, you know, definitely go up and talk to the band as well. Everybody is great in the band. They are super nice folks. So do yourself a favor and take the opportunity to do a meet and greet with these guys as well. And by meet and greet, I just mean go up and say hi. They will never, in my opinion, charge a fan to meet them or for an autograph. I know personally always loved dealing with them. In fact, when I had asked Josh if he minded if I rolled a whole entire track off it, he got right back to me, hey, sure, no problem. Play whatever you'd love to play on it. And that's kind of what I expected as well. But it's always good to keep in everybody's good graces. So again, from the great brand new one, Shadow Man, Tales from the Dead Side, from my friends in A Sound of Thunder, this is a great track. It's called Tremble. So for Richie, myself, and everybody else here in Focus on Metal, have yourself a great metal week. Enjoy this tune, and we'll talk to you again next week, right here on
Focus on Metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
You will not fear my name is...
Gaping maw. still here? It's over. Go home.